I next met with Dr. David Gandara, and to begin, I asked him about an interesting paper he wrote on a hot topic in GI cancer and also of interest to thoracic oncologists, the clinical and research implications of KRAS tumor mutations.
The importance of KRAS mutation right now has a definite therapeutic implication in colorectal cancer, where, for example, EGFR monoclonal antibodies such as cetuximab may not marry well with chemotherapy or even as a single agent in certain KRAS mutated cancers, where the data from three different data sets in non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma, I should say, now suggests that it's not important in terms of cetuximab activity. The kinds of mutations themselves, the prevalence of the mutations is also very different. So patients with colorectal cancer are most likely to have KRAS mutations that are not associated with cigarette smoking. About 10% of them do. But the majority of patients with colorectal cancer have transition mutations that are not tobacco carcinogen related, where in lung cancer, it's the opposite. How those KRAS mutations behave, what the prognostic significance is, and what I call the dancing partners, the other genes and the other mutations that are associated with KRAS are different between the two cancers. So once again, it means that although we're in a genomic age right now, that tumor type and the milieu of that tumor type takes precedent. And it's the most important thing. 5 years ago or 10 years ago, many academics in oncology said, by 2014, we will not be talking about tumor type. We'll say, this is a KRAS mutated cancer, or this is a P53 mutated cancer. But in reality, as time goes on, that underlying tumor type still is important and maybe even increasingly important.
Maybe kind of a basic question, but from a biologic point of view, what is a driver mutation?
That's a good question. It's actually being debated right now for KRAS. And again, KRAS may be a driver mutation in colorectal cancer. My own perception is that it is a driver mutation in lung cancer as well. But some of the data recently haven't panned out the way people expected. The driver would be important both in carcinogenesis, prognosis, because it would implicate perhaps a higher proliferative rate in that case, and also if you had a drug targeted against that abnormality, it would have predictive value. Because taking that agent against a KRAS mutated lung cancer, let's say for example, you should be able to shut it off, and that would result in a response. So for EGFR mutated lung cancer, all of those things are true. Carcinogenesis, prognosis, predictive value. For ALK translocated lung cancer, all of those things are true. For KRAS, it's been more difficult to show. My own impression is because we don't have the right drugs yet. The difficulty with KRAS mutations has been having a direct antagonist. So because of that, almost all the therapies have been looking at downstream pathway genes that could be blocked. For instance, one good example of this would be MEK. So MEK inhibitors are very effective in the laboratory against KRAS mutated lung cancers. In the clinic, there is some diversity in terms of the data. My own opinion, again, is that some of that is because of the diversity in the types of KRAS mutations, that not all mutations are created equal. The selumetinib data, for example, by Passiani, are very important data. This randomized trial where patients either received docetaxel plus selumetinib or docetaxel alone showed a substantial difference in response rate. It was over 30% for the combination. It was zero for docetaxel, which might be hard to believe, but for a practicing oncologist, I think we have to remind them this was in KRAS-mutated non-small cell lung cancer, not just all comers. The progression-free survival was markedly improved, and the overall survival was actually improved, although not statistically significant, because this was a randomized phase 2 trial. It was not definitive. The toxicity was substantial. We more recently did a trial with GSK212, also known as trametinib, which is approved in melanoma, in combination with docetaxel. But because of the myelosuppression that was seen in the previous study, we added cycle 1 growth factor. And this did ameliorate the toxicity. We saw about a 30% activity in both KRAS-mutated lung cancer and KRAS wild-type. Some critics then said, well, you didn't really show any specificity for KRAS. So my opinion there was the response rate in this combination in KRAS could have been very low. And in fact, it brought it up to the level of the wild-type cancers. But the most important thing we showed was that the type of KRAS mutation was also important. The most common tobacco-related KRAS mutation is the G12C, makes up around 35% or maybe a little more in some series in lung cancer. Very uncommon in colorectal cancer. Every single one of those patients treated with the combination had a positive waterfall plot, by which I mean they had tumor shrinkage. The response rate, and again, it's a small number of patients, only 10 patients, but the response rate was 4 out of 10, 40%. The disease control rate was 8 out of 10. But everybody had a positive waterfall. So subsequent studies are going to look at this in a very careful way and see, do we have some sort of mutation specificity in targeting KRAS, at least with this class of drugs?
Do you see any of the sort of dramatic responses that you see with, you know, crizotinib or EGFR TKIs?
That's a great question. The data that I'm familiar with, and I've used both of these MEK inhibitors in clinical trials, is that the response rate is much more gradual. And in fact, what we encouraged investigators is not to give up if there was stable disease after a couple of cycles, because some of the patients did not reach RECIST PR for 6 or 8 cycles. So this is very different from, let's say, an EGFR TKI. The other thing is I do think there's some magic in combination of taxanes with the MEK inhibitors in this setting. Another component of the trial that we did used pemetrexed. There was no mutation specificity, and the data were just not as strong. There are a lot of preclinical data about why an antimicrotubule agent might be more effective in combination with MEK in KRAS-mutated lung cancer. So I think that follows up on data that would have been suspected from the preclinical.
How exclusive are mutations, specifically KRAS? If you have any of these KRAS mutations, does that mean you won't have, you know, an ALK translocation or EGFR?
Yeah, the question of having dual mutations, we have to put this in the perspective of the data from next-generation sequencing, where we know that lung cancer is the most mutated cancer of all. And there are literally hundreds of abnormalities, gene copy number, true mutations, translocations, a variety of things. That doesn't mean that there couldn't be a single driver in those cases, or at least a single driver at a time. What we have found is that in the carcinogen-induced KRAS mutations, de novo, you will not see an EGFR mutation or an ALK fusion, but you do see them in evolution after therapy, for instance, with an EGFR TKI. However, if it's a non-tobacco-related carcinogen-induced KRAS mutation, then you do see them. And we were the first people ever to report that de novo, you could have a KRAS mutant lung cancer and it also had an EGFR sensitizing mutation. Those are the sorts of cases where I think the KRAS is not the driver. It's coexisting.
From a more global point of view, where do you think this is all heading? Do you think the dream of being able to unfold this and find the right target is going to play out over the next 20 years or, you know, maybe crash?
The genomic subsetting, at least in lung cancer, will not crash. We already have several validated targets and we have drugs in clinical practice. How far the pie is filled out? In other words, is it stop at 60%? Does it stop at 85%? That's less clear. And the reason, I think, is sorting out the passengers from the drivers. In other words, what's there? We already can fill out the pie 100%. That doesn't mean that all of those are true therapeutic targets or even true therapeutic targets in an individual patient. And what I mean by that is if you have patient A and patient B, the abnormality may be a driver in one and not in the other. That's the difficulty. Also, patient A may have multiple clones in his tumor. In fact, we expect that he does. Again, over time, one of those other clones, which could be actually a less resilient clone, grows out because you have suppressed the dominant clone. That's the reason for not only biopsy, but rebiopsy. Some of our patients with oncogene-driven non-small cell lung cancer are now on their fourth biopsy, and they're 4 years later. And we're finding that they started with X, then they went to Y, and now they're on Z. What happens after Z is still unclear.
Yeah, I was curious about that. There's a lot of literature in breast cancer about consistency of ER and HER2 over time, you know, primary metastatic disease. What do we know about the same question in lung cancer?
The issue about primary versus metastatic lung cancer and the consistency of oncogenes depends on how deep you dig. For the primary oncogenes, such as EGFR mutation and ALK, there's about a 75% consistency. Over time, that can diverge further and under the influence of treatment. We did a very interesting survey ourselves a year or so ago where we asked several hundred practicing oncologists versus 10 experts. If you had a choice in a lung cancer patient who is a never-smoking patient of biopsying the primary or a metastasis, and it was equal risk, which would be the most informative for molecular testing?
That's a great question. I predict everybody said met.
All of the experts said metastasis. 80% of the practicing oncologists said the primary.
Really? Wow.
I don't know that one is right versus the other, but I think the experts figured that the worst actors in that cancer cause the metastasis. Therefore, if I have one chance to do a biopsy and there's no increase in risk, I'm going after the metastasis. I think the practicing oncologist, my own feeling, is that they thought, well, maybe the primary is the true driver and the metastasis won't have it. So we don't know for sure which of those is right, but I thought it was very interesting that there was such a divergence between the practicing physicians and the lung cancer experts.
It really is interesting and something that doesn't come up in breast cancer very often because people present more sequentially. What are your thoughts? What do you do? I don't even know people even think about it. I think they just think maybe what's the easiest way to get tissue. Do you think it makes a difference?
Well, I think the most important thing is to get adequate tissue. You're well aware that several guidelines have come out about molecular testing in lung cancer over the last year or so. The ones that we developed for the International Association Study of Lung Cancer, ISLC, were published in conjunction with the American College of Pathology and also the AMP this past year. And among those recommendations is that right now the molecular testing is most applicable to patients with an adenocarcinoma component to their cancer. It could be a mixture of adenosquamous, but that it should not discriminate against patients because they are older. It should not discriminate against patients because they are smokers or have been heavy smokers in the past. that the tissue should be acquired by a biopsy that gives you a minimum of 3 mm³ of tumor. So that's typically a core needle biopsy or an open biopsy. But now that's even changing somewhat because we've gotten much better. I shouldn't say we. The interventional radiologists have gotten much better about doing multi-pass fine needle aspirations so that instead of doing one or two passes, they do 15 or 20 passes, and you end up with as much tissue as you would have with the core needle. But many of them feel the pneumothorax, let's say if it's a deep lung lesion, the pneumothorax rate is less because you're already in that tumor. So I think that's important. How do you get the tumor? When do you get it? And then when do you go back and rebiopsy?
What's your answer in terms of rebiopsy? And that kind of also introduces the issue of resistance that you've talked a lot about.
For a patient with an oncogene-driven cancer, when they fail that first EGFR TKI, that's your first opportunity to meaningfully rebiopsy the cancer. Although it's been debated in some of our meetings, what if you rebiopsied the tumor earlier? In other words, could you actually find the lead early on that resistance is emerging and then act on it to head off that resistance? Some very interesting data were presented along this line, and it follows up on our own work on finding these driver mutations in plasma DNA. So this is not in circulating tumor cells. It's actually free DNA. So you and I have about a nanogram per ml of hopefully normal DNA in our blood. Cancer patients on average have about 3 to 4 nanogram per ml. For 10 years, and we were actually, I think, the first to show this, we've been able, with sensitive techniques, to detect KRAS mutations, EGFR mutations in plasma. Tony Mock, in his FASTAC trial, did a very interesting thing. It was actually the FASTAC 2. They acquired blood specimens in patients with EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. And they did the plasma DNA analysis for the mutation up front. And there was, I think, about a 90% concordance. If it was in the tumor, it was in the plasma. And then they followed that. And at the end of 3 months of erlotinib-based therapy, they rechecked the blood. Those patients that had cleared the mutation went on to have a long progression-free survival. The patients that still had persistence of the mutation in their blood after 3 cycles of therapy tended to fail very quickly. So this is the example, I think, of what I was talking about, being able to find something in the plasma that will tell you you need to change your strategy. So Tony, to his credit, he's a very bright guy, is now designing a trial where you will alter therapy based on the persistence of the mutation. Along that same line, we know that one of the common mechanisms of resistance is emergence of a second mutation, a gatekeeper mutation, T790M. For almost the same amount of time, about perhaps 7 years, we've been able to show that you can identify it in plasma as well. So if you found a patient with T790M in their plasma after 3 months, again, that might tell you that patient's going to fail quickly. I want to intervene with my second drug, which could be added to erlotinib in this case, or which would replace erlotinib if it's, let's say, a second or third generation EGFR TKI.
There's obviously been a lot of interest in immune therapy in lung cancer. What do you see as the intersection between that strategy and sort of targeted therapy? Is there any reason to think there might be some synergy?
Okay, so I love the way this question was phrased. You say the intersection between immunotherapy and targeted therapy. I may be an outlier here, but the new drugs, the anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 drugs, I refer to as targeted therapy. They have a target. They're going after a target, PD-L1. Although the data are mixed, we will figure out how to accurately measure that target and the other components that go along with it, because it may not just be as simple as measuring the PD-L1. And those drugs, I think, are going to be proven to be most effective in the patients that have that target or that pathway. And it's potential that that target could even be induced. So in that regard, I do look at these as targeted agents. They don't work in everyone. So when we talk about combining these with other agents, there's a great deal of interest in taking a patient that has the PD-L1 target and an EGFR mutation or an ALK fusion and doing combination therapy or some other combination where we feel that that removal of the defense mechanism from the tumor could make the therapy with the TKI more effective. In other words, perhaps that anti-PD-L1 drug would make erlotinib a better drug in EGFR mutated lung cancer. So there's a great deal of interest there. But the data are very preliminary. It's primarily still in the lab.
Any other sort of trial strategies out there that you're interested in, particularly using, you know, translational models such as the one you described? What other things are being talked about? Where do you see things heading with clinical research?
There is a revolution in clinical trial design now. As a bit of background, the pharmaceutical industry, I think, despite themselves, despite knowing that they develop targeted agents, for almost 15 years in lung cancer, they have attempted to use what I call the spaghetti approach, which basically throwing their drug against the wall with chemotherapy and hoping that it will stick. It almost never stuck. And in fact, in a recent review that we did, we looked at about 22 trials of trying to add targeted agents to chemotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer. Only two were positive. So we realize now that these targeted agents have a target. If the patient has the target, they are most likely to benefit. We have to figure out for every one of the new drug classes as early as possible what that target is, how to measure it, how to develop a clinically and analytically validated assay, and put it in clinical trials early enough so that by the time you're ready to try to do the definitive phase 3 trial with your drug and your biomarker, you're ready to go. And at the end of the day, you have an approved drug and you have an approved companion diagnostic, to use the current terminology. About 2 years ago, the Lung Cancer Thoracic Malignancy Steering Committee, that's the NCI committee for directing trials, met with the FDA, the EMA, the pharmaceutical industry, and the NCI itself in a meeting in Bethesda on this issue of developing better clinical trials. And one of the outcomes of that meeting was that we needed master protocols. And what I mean by that is a protocol that could take a large group of patients, thousands of patients, that had a certain category of cancer, do a genomic analysis, if that's what was required, and be able to treat those patients in multiple different ways depending on what was found in that patient's cancer. So we have done this. It's taken us 2 years. We're hoping this will actually launch in April. It's called the Master Lung Protocol, or S1400. Dr. Valli Papadimitropoulo from MD Anderson is the chair of the trial. Roy Herbst from Yale is the chair of the steering committee, because the partners on this are NCI, FDA. They're helping us write the consent forms. Friends of Cancer Research, the foundation of the NIH, and the pharmaceutical company. So the foundation of the NIH is the purse holder for pharmaceutical industry to participate in this enterprise. This is to change the way we do business in drug development. Each one of these arms of the master protocol is phase 2/3, meaning that it meets an intermediate hurdle, and if it meets that hurdle, in a comparison to a standard of care drug, it goes on to phase 3, and it's with a biomarker, At the end of the day, if it's a positive trial for progression-free survival, that drug and that biomarker will be FDA approved.
Now, this concept I've heard of, the master protocol with reference to lung cancer, is the idea of then taking that model, moving it out into the entire field of cancer beyond that?
If we're successful in lung cancer, yes, we will want to both take this into other tumor types and to globalize this. Already, there is a master protocol group working in Europe and another one working in Asia. Last week, there was a meeting with the colorectal doctors to develop their own master protocol. We have to show that this strategy can work. We have to show that we can efficiently screen over 1,000 patients per year. In this case, we're starting with squamous cell lung cancer because that's an unmet need. And within 10 days, give next-generation sequencing information. Foundation Medicine's our partner. And place that patient into a trial and have a successful outcome. So there are many moving parts here in a way that no one has ever done this.
The one part of this that you brought up that I hadn't heard, it's kind of interesting, is how industry fits in. It sounds like you're trying to set up an infrastructure and then what industry applies to get involved with it? How does it work?
They do. And as a matter of fact, the first round of applications from industry, we had 17 pharmaceutical companies propose 26 new drugs to us. And we had a drug selection committee. All of this is very transparent, that for several weeks, almost every other day, we had a call with pharma and talked about their drug, talked about their biomarker, and would it fit, was it at the right timeline in the natural history of that drug and that biomarker to put it in the master protocol? We propose that this will not only be very time efficient once it's up and running, so that it will shorten the time for pharma, not lengthen it, but that it will be extraordinarily cost efficient. Let's just say that you're pharma company A, and you have a very potent drug against a new gene that's been found in lung cancer, but only 2% of the population have that genotype. How do you engage investigators at sites, either in the United States or globally, to test 100 patients so that you get two? Pharma is struggling with this. And in fact, some pharmaceutical companies have said, if the prevalence is that low, we're not going after it. But we know from CML and many other examples now that if you can do this in the right way, you can actually, pharmaceutical companies can actually be profitable even for a drug with a rare cancer. And the worst thing to do would be to leave out those patients with the rare genotypes out of the revolution that's occurring in new drug development. So if we have a master protocol and we're screening over 1,000 patients a year with a certain kind of cancer, and we have six arms open at the same time, and the prevalence varies from 40% to 2%, we project a hit rate of at least 65 to 70%, meaning that a physician who takes his patient and puts them through this process, we will have at least a 65 to 70% chance of matching them with a treatment. That's the novel component to this. That's the magic. We can make this work for patients and physicians and pharma in a way that's never been done before. And then you might say, well, what about that 30% that didn't match? So we've tried to anticipate that. We have what's called a non-match arm. Our first non-match arm will be an anti-PD-L1 drug.
That's
because
kind of predictable.
Everybody's trying to figure out, how do you measure it? Is it sufficient, et cetera? So if the patient doesn't match in one of the other arms, they go on to PD-L1, and we gain data about the biomarker while the trial is going on. And if we gain enough data, the FDA has agreed that we can do, when I say we, this whole project, along with the foundation of the NCI, et cetera, that we can do bridging studies to allow that biomarker to be used for subsequent registration of the drug. So this has required a lot of thinking and a tremendous amount of effort by everyone involved. This project will be known as S1400, SWOG 1400, but every intergroup, all the different groups are participating, and the different groups will lead arms of the trial, depending on their expertise. So for instance, if Alliance has the data on a certain drug in, let's say, an early phase 1-2 trial, they will lead that arm of the study, or ECOG, Akron, et cetera.
I think about, you know, over the last few years, some of the things that sort of remind me of it. You mentioned Roy Herbst. I was thinking about the battle initiative that he and Ed Kim and all did. To me, that at least just getting tissue and, you know, beginning this kind of process. And then I guess the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium kind of seems like it lined up. It seems like this is sort of taking those concepts and just taking it to the next level.
I think BATTLE and the Lung Cancer Molecular Consortium or Mutation Consortium are the seeds that were planted that led to this master protocol. The work at MD Anderson on BATTLE 1 and now BATTLE 2 and the work by the LCMC showed the feasibility that we can do this. This is to take it into an infrastructure that becomes self-sustaining. And what I mean by that is, let's say that arm one doesn't meet the interim endpoint. In other words, the drug wasn't that effective. That closes. A new arm one comes in. Or one of the arms is going all the way through phase three, but the prevalence has dropped because one of the high prevalence genotypes didn't pan out. We add additional arms. So we're hoping that this will change the way we do business and drug development, and that 10 years from now, this master protocol will still be needed, because for industry, for the FDA, which is very interested in this, they want a better system. For everyone, for patients, the patient advocacy groups are very enthusiastic about this. If this is successful, we will change the way we do business and drug development, and we will get better drugs to patients faster and more cost efficient.
What is the spectrum of mutations that you see in squamous cell?
In squamous cell lung cancer, the number of true oncogenic drivers is, of course, not as prominent, but fibroblast growth factor receptor abnormalities, amplification, increased expression, PI3 kinase abnormalities, very common. Abnormalities in cell cycling, P53 mutations, PD-L1, if anything, perhaps more common in squamous cell lung cancer than it is in adeno with the assays that have been used so far. These are some of the targets that are actionable. There are drugs that could go against those targets. And several of those will be in the initial version of the master protocol.
It's interesting. You mentioned that it was squamous cell, but it sort of flew by me a little bit. Is there any immediate interest in doing this in non-squamous?
The reason that the master protocol started with squamous cell lung cancer is that it was an unmet need and that the space was less crowded. For adenocarcinoma, for example, the pharmaceutical companies are already highly engaged in looking at a lot of new targets, but everybody needs help in squamous cell. The pharmaceutical industry has some strategies in squamous cell, but this enables them to bring it together where we can screen a large number of patients and make it easier for them to get patients into their studies.